Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Overnight America with Ryan Recker on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
And welcome to Overnight America. It just happened moments ago, right before we went on the air. The wrap up for the day. The Trump legal team concludes their arguments. They put in their closer, Alan Dershowitz. He was the man to close it tonight. There's a couple of different arguments. Maybe we'll cover those on the show later tonight. We're going to set up our friend Rich Rubino, and I always look for historical reference points from him. We do that at every Monday night, so he's going to join us in about 10 minutes from now. Next hour, Tom Sullivan is going to talk about the Loop Trolley. He's had a lot of concerns over the years, not just recently. He just didn't jump on the band trolley. He was on this thing to begin with, and it looks like this thing could possibly be kaput. So what happens next? And you know, he goes to all the meetings and he makes some pretty strong arguments. We're going to talk to him in about an hour from now, and then we'll talk more about the impeachment hearing and everything that went down. So lots to get to on the show tonight. I do have some audio clips. This book from Bolton is quite a wrinkle. I wouldn't say it's necessarily a bombshell per se, but it is a wrinkle and it could be a pretty big one. Is it to the bombshell level? We'll discuss. We'll get to that. Here's the phone number if you want to text or call in. It's 314-436-7900 or 800-925-1120. So like I mentioned, not that long ago, just before we went on the air here, as we're doing this live in St. Louis, Missouri, if you're listening on the replay hour, this would have happened some hours ago, but still, they closed down the impeachment hearing with Alan Dershowitz. Oh, I had it queued up and I tried to bring it back. Let me back up real quick, and I'll play some of this for you.
These articles of somewhat more specific but still non-criminal type conduct. The specifications are themselves vague, open-ended, and do not charge impeachable offenses. They include such accusations as compromising national security, abusing the power of the presidency, violating his oath of office. In any event, it's the actual articles that charge abuse of power and obstruction of justice, neither of which are in the Constitution. It's the actual articles on which you must all vote, not on the more specific list of means included in the text of the articles. An analogy to a criminal indictment might be helpful. If a defendant were accused of dishonesty, committing the crime of dishonesty, it wouldn't matter that the indictment listed as well the means toward dishonesty a variety of far more specific potential offenses. Dishonesty is simply not a crime. It's too broad a concept. It's not in the statutes. It's not a crime. The indictment would be dismissed because dishonesty is a sin and not a crime, even if the indictment included a long list of more specific acts of dishonesty. Nor can impeachment be based on a bunching together of non-impeachable sins, none of which, standing alone, meet the constitutional criteria. Only if at least one constitutionally authorized offense is proved can the Senate then consider other conduct in deciding the discretionary issue of whether removal is warranted. In other words, your jurisdiction is based on commission of an impeachable offense. Once that jurisdictional element is satisfied, you have broad discretion to determine whether removal is warranted, and you consider a wide array of conduct, criminal and non-criminal. But you have no jurisdiction to remove unless there is at least one impeachable offense within the meaning of high crimes and misdemeanors. In the 3 days of argument, the House managers tossed around words even vaguer and more open-ended than abuse and obstruction to justify their case for removal.
This is Alan Dershowitz just moments ago, right before they wrapped up
trust,
the day.
Truth, honesty, and finally, right. These aspirational words of virtue are really important, but they demonstrate the failure of the managers to distinguish alleged political sins from constitutionally impeachable offenses. We all want our presidents and other public officials to live up to the highest standards set by Washington and Lincoln, though both of them were accused of abuse of power by their political opponents. The framers could have demanded that all presidents must meet Congressman Schiff's standards of being honest, trustworthy, virtuous, and right in order to complete their terms. But they didn't, because they understand human fallibility. As Madison put it, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. And then, speaking of presidents and other public officials, if angels were to govern men, neither internal nor external controls on government would be necessary. The framers understood that if they set the criteria.
So this was just not that long ago. In fact, this is all, I'll pause it right there. But Alan Dershowitz was called in. I guess he was the closer for the night for the Republicans in defense of the president. There was multiple people, of course, that spoke throughout the course of the day. One person that was making a lot of people online chatter was Pam Bondi. Wow. She laid out the case of why, indeed, Hunter Biden would be a worthy person to call into not only criticism, but warrant investigation. There is a lot of pieces that just stick together, and all of a sudden you put together a pretty strong case against what happened and what was allowed to happen. And between Hunter Biden and what was his father's, not just influence, but what was his father's actions that led to that sort of thing. And it's a lot of things happened timeline-wise right after one after another after another. And she spent about a half hour on the floor today in Capitol Hill. We'll play some of that later for you today, too. And we'll all get to what really happened. And sure, there's a lot to unpack. Of course, they had all of Saturday. Today would have been another day for the Republicans to make their case. I think they saved most of it for today, some of the big unpacking of what's going on. But as you can hear, the defense of Alan Dershowitz, and he said this and has been pretty consistent with this, saying that based on the accusations against the president, this doesn't really meet the standard of what would be impeachable, as in remove from office, or what would qualify to remove a president from office. So we'll talk to Rich Rubino about that, his book, American Politics on the Rocks. I want to talk to him a little bit about what's going on, but mostly I want to focus on Iowa. We're getting close to that. In endorsements, newspaper endorsements, the history of those, and are they anything of value? We'll join him right after the break on Overnight America, KMOX.
Now back to Overnight America on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
Welcome back. Overnight America continues, and on Mondays we have what I feel some of the best discussions of the week on KMOX with Rich Rubino, author of American Politics on the Rocks, politi-geek.com. You can find him online. Let's welcome him in now. Thanks for coming back on, Rich.
Oh, glad to be here again.
Exciting week. So of the impeachment trial going on in Washington, D.C., of all the hours that have been broadcasted, how many of them have you watched?
I would say about a quarter, probably.
Okay.
I get a lot of it more as the highlights. I mean, obviously, some of them are very interesting. Alan Dershowitz is, for example, a very good presenter. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, you know, for example, when you listen to the managers, I thought Adam Schiff did a very good job. But I think when you listen to some of them, they're essentially, it's like Mo Udall used to say, everything's been said, but not everyone said it yet.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's a lot of it. So I think you're getting, you know, you're getting a lot of repetition, but you can get a lot of the coverage just by, you know, just by kind of seeing the major parts of it. You can get a lot of the coverage without having to watch the whole thing, although some people are enamored by it.
And watching 25% probably covers 100% of the content, because a lot of it is just restating the same thing over and over and over again. There's probably very good justification to put some timetables on this thing, mostly because from what we've seen, there's been more than enough time to lay out the argument at this point.
And the fascinating thing, too, is, as I always say, barring a cataclysm, and, you know, I don't think the John Bolton thing rises to that level, but we'll see. Barring a cataclysm, we know pretty much how 98% of the senators are going to vote anyway. So,
yeah.
And even, you know, so it's really, it's a matter of, it's really a matter of the Democrats trying to enfeeble President Trump for the 2020 election, and it's a matter of the Republicans trying to defend President Trump and saying that this is a witch hunt. So, I mean, it's really a political thing. I don't think anybody realistically believes that the Senate is actually going to convict the president.
You know, what's interesting what you just said, because a lot of people in the media right now are calling the John Bolton thing a bombshell. So
yes.
Do you think it rises? You make it sound like you don't believe this rises to the level of a bombshell.
Well, I don't know. It could. I'm just saying right now, we don't know if it. We don't know it because we haven't heard from John Bolton. It's amazing, by the way, you can get a manuscript done in that short period of a time.
Uh-huh.
But if something is in there, and if John Bolton does come out and he, you know, does some sort of a public relations campaign as opposed to actually testifying, then, you know, we have no idea what essentially he's saying. So that's why I always say at the beginning, when I knew that this was going to essentially be, you know, the Republicans were very unlikely to get this, where the Democrats, rather, were very unlikely to get the 67 votes, always barring some sort of a cataclysmic event. And John Bolton does kind of go rogue, if you will, and argue with and take the opposite side of the president, then that potentially could be the cataclysmic event, but I don't know yet.
Yeah. All right. So I wanted to mostly mention at the very onset of the interview something that you've been talking about over the weeks. And when it came to scheduling the impeachment trial, what a disadvantage it put the Democratic candidates at, because they're going to be inside of these hearings, which means they're not going to be on the campaign trail. So those that are not in the Senate, including the Joe Bidens and Pete Buttigiegs of the world, the
yep.
Bloombergs and the Steyers and the Yangs of the world, they have a huge advantage right now, because they are out there and they're hitting the street, and Iowa is right around the corner. So what do you see? Do you think that they could start eroding some of the Elizabeth Warrens and the Bernie Sanders numbers away as they get more face time?
Well, Bloomberg, of course, is not competing in the first four states, so I'll take him out of the equation. He's kind of a null set right now. Of the other candidates, you know, I can kind of see it going both ways, because what you have seen with these candidates, particularly a candidate like Amy Klobuchar, for example, who's not there, but she's getting a lot of press coverage, in part, you know, she's certainly on the Sunday shows, but also the fact that she's gotten some instrumental endorsements, one of them being the New Hampshire Union, the Manchester Union Leader in New Hampshire, and also a few papers in Iowa. But she's getting a lot of coverage based on that, and also there's so much coverage of the candidates and the fact that they're in the impeachment hearings and that they're not on the campaign trail. It almost supersizes the coverage that the other candidates are getting for actually being in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're hearing about every time Bernie Sanders in the morning, they all go and all the press, you know, just absolutely conglomerates to him. It's just a cavalcade of media people going and asking him, you know, what you think of this was going on, what you think this was going on, and they're getting a lot of free media in that respect. They're also sending a lot of their surrogates out to do a lot of the campaigning for them. Joe Biden, for example, is one, and Pete Buttigieg, you're right, and, you know, I guess Michael Bennett, although he's more campaigning for New Hampshire, but mm-hmm. they're spending a lot of their time doing it themselves. But candidates like Amy Klobuchar has Tim Walz, for example, the governor of her home state of Minnesota. She has Minnesota people going out and kind of, you know, singing her plaudits, for example. So they are getting a lot of coverage. I don't know how much of that kind of down home and actually going to, you know, the cookout at Sioux City, Iowa, or meeting with people directly. I don't know how much that's necessarily going to benefit them, but they're, you know, you're getting coverage. These candidates are getting a lot of coverage, both of them, all of them.
Richard Bino joining us here on Overnight America. And I wanted to ask you about just the coverage that we've seen so far. You know, when they are interested in talking to a senator, it is not the Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. They want to talk to Mitt Romney. They want to
yes.
talk to the Republicans, because they want to know, are they having any sort of change of thought as the process is going along? So that stunts them too. Even some of the camera time that they would hope to get while they're doing their duties inside of the Senate, that's not happening for them either.
Although they are getting, I mean, they are getting a lot of coverage. Certainly, if you go and, you know, you see who all the press is going over to, you know, they're not going to Pat Roberts of Kansas, because
yeah.
nobody knows Pat Roberts of Kansas is. So they are going to the candidates that are running for president, and they're getting a lot of media time for being at the Senate trial and actually doing their due diligence and actually doing the job that they were actually elected to do, you know, doing their day job. They are getting a lot of coverage in terms of, you know, Mitt Romney, I guess Lisa Murkowski from Alaska. There are a few senators that are kind of seen as being on the bubble. Mitt Romney, potentially, you know, would Lamar Alexander, for example, decide that they would support witnesses based on what's going on in terms of John Bolton. So they're getting a lot of media coverage. But, you know, basically there's probably about 10 to 15 senators that are, I think, getting probably the preponderance of the coverage. And usually it's just because they're the ones that are the most outspoken. you know, obviously the ones that get the most media time. I mean, Lindsey Graham, obviously he's chairman of the Judiciary Committee. You're going to go for it. You're going to go after him. Of course, you're going to go after Mitch McConnell because he's the Senate Majority Leader. You're going to go after Chuck Schumer. And there are a lot, like, you know, there are a lot of senators that a lot of people have really never heard of. Like, you know, Ron Wyden from Oregon, for example, doesn't make much of a presence. He's more interested in kind of state-type issues. But all the ones that, you know, trying to get national attention, all the ones that have some sort of presidential contention in their future, obviously those ones are going to get a lot of the coverage. And, you know, obviously you go toward those presidential candidates, and they're sure that Bernie Sanders is being prepped exactly what he's supposed to say. And, you know, it's essentially the hour, and essentially it is a campaign because you see how much press goes to each one of them. And you go to Bernie Sanders, you go to Elizabeth Warren, and then that's essentially the sound bites you're seeing in the coverage. And you're seeing a lot of those, I'm sure, on the Iowa television stations as well.
Yeah. You know, there was one moment, I don't know if you saw, when Ken Starr was giving testimony.
Yes.
And there was a quote he basically said, and if I'm getting the gist of this quote correctly, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but essentially what he's saying is we've gone down the road where almost everyone wants to yell every offense is impeachable. So we're overusing the term impeachment. Maybe I'm getting that out of context, but do you think that's where we're at? You feel like, you know, even during the Obama administration, something would come up and immediately people would say, we need to impeach him over this. You didn't hear so much during the George W. Bush, but really it's ramped up ever since the Clinton presidency. And now with President Trump, it seems like everything rises to the level of impeachment no matter what he does.
There's some veracity to the argument, but he's probably the worst possible messenger to make that argument.
Based on his involvement, yeah.
Because he was, of course, the one in the 1990s, he was charged with investigating a land deal gone wrong in Arkansas in the 1970s, and somehow he got from that to Monica Lewinsky, and he was the one who essentially recommended that Bill Clinton be impeached in the 1990s. He was the one who, for example, got Susan McDougal, put her in, you know, essentially in handcuffs and put her in jail for not testifying against the Clintons. He was the one who, you know, he did get some convictions. He got Jim Guy Tucker, the governor. He got Jim McDougal. He did get Susan McDougal, but he's probably the worst possible messenger. Now, that being said, the message is probably accurate. Impeachment is not seen as necessarily a political tool. It's seen for the most extreme for the most extreme infractions that a president can, or for that matter, a federal judge can commit. You know, high crimes or other high treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Obviously, that's in the eye of the beholder what it is. But there were some movements during the Bush administration for the Iraq War. There were Dennis Kucinich, for example, from Ohio, one of the most progressive, most liberal members, did have a resolution that would have impeached Dick Cheney for what he said was misleading about the claims that Iraq had a nexus with al-Qaeda and the claims that they had weapons of mass destruction. During Obama, there was actually Republican Walter Jones, a very conservative member of North Carolina, proposed impeaching President Obama for drone strikes, which he thought he did not have the proper congressional authorization for. But you're right. I mean, it is certainly it's a political tool. It's only supposed to be used in the most extreme circumstances. But obviously, I mean, Gerald Ford, when he was in Congress, he thought he wanted to impeach Justice Douglas, and he said in part, you know, essentially impeachment is whatever you essentially make it out to be. And you know, but as he still, you know, it is definitely a political process, and it definitely is overused. But Kenneth Starr is probably the last person you'd want to hear that message from.
And we continue our conversation with Rich Rubino. One other thing before we go to break, and you know, I should have given you a preview of this question just in case. But here's the thing: I'm going to put the pressure on you because your political knowledge is so vast. You probably know the answer to this ahead of time.
Oh boy!
So some people are saying that President Trump should cancel the State of the Union that's scheduled to come up next week because of the impeachment hearings. Did President Clinton give a State of the Union during his impeachment?
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, so in 1998, the year before the impeachment, in 1999, I remember he did give an impeach. He did give a State of the Union. I believe it might have been after the actual trial, though. He was actually acquitted.
It wasn't during.
In 1998, though, right after, as the Monica Lewinsky story broke, he actually, and this was at the time when Wolf Blitzer, other people were coming on television, and they were directly saying that, I think the president's going to resign next week, he's going to resign tomorrow, everything else. So the first thing he did, and actually Harry Tomlinson, who was the Hollywood advisor, who was from Arkansas, who had advised him in this presidential campaign, said you have to go out there and go on the offensive. So the first thing they did in 1998, he had an event where Al Gore, the vice president, was supposed to speak, and it was a routine preview of the State of the Union address where they essentially promoted a child care initiative he was going to talk about. So Bill Clinton says, I'm going to give the speech. So he goes out there, he gives a 20-minute address about his support for the child care initiative. Then at the end of the address, he comes on, finally, I want to say something to the American people. I want you to listen to me, because I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anyone to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day, he delivered the State of the Union address, and he had no mention whatsoever of what was going on with the impeachment, and it was probably one of the best addresses that he ever gave, and that was one of the things that held his job approval rating over 60%. The next day he was in Illinois, he was going all around the country, like he always does, the next 3 or 4 days, promoting what he said in his State of the Union address, and that showed, I think, a lot of Republicans that he was not going to be a pushover, and essentially, you know, he began that offensive, you know, he misled on the first day, second day, he never brought up the whole impeachment thing, but he showed that he's essentially going to stay there. He made a bunch of initiatives, a bunch of, you know, like he always used to do, these 1-hour speeches, laundry list of issues, and that's what he did. Then he gave the State of the Union next couple of years, but it was really one of the probably most fascinating moments in American history, because people were saying, is he going to leave? Is he going to leave? Will he actually give the State of the Union address? And he did give his State of the Union address, but what he didn't do is he didn't call in to the team that won the Super Bowl that year, because that was right around that time as well. And usually the president calls in and congratulates them, but that's one thing he did not do at that period.
Oh, interesting. Well, that's a good perspective. I knew you would know the answer to that. I knew it. Those pop quizzes, you're so good. Rich Rubino, American Politics on the Rocks is the name of the book. If you don't mind holding on, I want to talk Iowa, and I want to talk newspaper endorsements, because there's been a few of them that came out. I think it's interesting. I don't know if it moves the needle, but newspapers still do this. It's kind of weird that they do it, if you think about it. But let's do that right after the break, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
You can check them out online, polita-geek.com. We'll be right back on Overnight America, KMOX.
News Radio 1120, KMOX, the voice of the Cardinals.
And on Mondays, we hook up with Rich Rubino. The book is American Politics on the Rocks. His website, polita-geek.com. Thank you for holding on, Rich.
Oh, you're welcome.
In Iowa, there's a lot of people focused on that right now. I see the town halls, people showing up in the crowds. I see the news articles, the different people from the media that are there reporting on it. We're getting really close. What are some of your impressions of what's going down now in Iowa?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, Iowa, in many respects, they're there by accident. That's, people always say, why Iowa? Why is Iowa first? You know, it's not necessarily an archetype of the nation, you know, a state that's, for example, you know, about 95%, you know, white, very more agriculture than the rest of the nation. And part of that is actually by accident. 1972, you go back, basically, the state decided they were going to have their state convention early because there wasn't enough hotel room to have it when they normally would have it. So they decided to have it in 72 to do other things, but one of the things they had was essentially a presidential caucus, and George McGovern that year, an obscure senator from South Dakota with a 200-to-1 long shot, decided he was going to campaign there. He was going to campaign there vigorously. He ends up coming into second to uncommitted, and then he gets third to uncommitted after uncommitted, then the establishment candidate Ed Muskie of Maine, then he comes in third, and then he gets an inordinate amount of attention because he did so well and no one thought he was going to. Then 4 years down the road, Jimmy Carter spends a lot of time there, 1975, 1976, this Keenan Brigade campaigning all over the state. He ends up coming in second to uncommitted, gets a lot of attention, and that's a launching pad for him to win the nomination. In terms of what's going on right now, I think what you're seeing is it really could go to about potentially, you know, this would be a huge boost if Pete Buttigieg could somehow win the state of Iowa. If he does not win the state of Iowa and he does not win the state of New Hampshire, I don't really see where his campaign is going from there, because eventually you're going to get to Nevada and then you're going to get to South Carolina, which is kind of Joe Biden's firewall because he's so popular with the African-American community, and the state's about 60%, at least in the Democratic primary, African-American. So he really needs the state. Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, I don't think, needed it quite as much. Elizabeth Warren could come back, and she'd have to probably win New Hampshire. Bernie Sanders certainly would have to win New Hampshire. So it's not necessarily do or die for them. Joe Biden, certainly, he potentially could lose all three of the first three states and then potentially come back in South Carolina. The one I'm really watching is Amy Klobuchar, because she has really spent about as much time as you possibly can going to all 99 counties of the entire state and going to some of the more obscure counties, talking about agriculture-type issues, talking about how we don't need a revolution, we need stuff that can get done. So she's going to be interesting to see how she does specifically in Iowa. If she does not perform well, I don't see how she moves on into New Hampshire, South Carolina. But if she does perform, if she can somehow get herself in the top four, I think the same thing happened with, like, she can mimic the strategy Fred Harris had in 1976. He came in fourth place. He wasn't supposed to do that well. He said, Iowa has winnowed me in, as opposed to being winnowed out. And candidates like Andrew Yang, I think, and Tom Steyer are just going to stay in the race because I think they're not necessarily see themselves as winning in Iowa. They see this more as a long game. For Andrew Yang, I think he sees himself more or less as the affectionator of a movement as opposed to somebody who's actually necessarily winning to win the presidential race.
Yeah, I think Andrew Yang qualified for the next debate.
In New Hampshire, yes.
I mean, he was out, now back in. He's someone that has really been hitting the pavement. He's been working hard to keep his name out there. And I see that the Bloomberg ads are airing all the time. So he is spending a lot of money right now, even though he's not going to be in the next debate, but his foresight's a little bit further than that. You know what that reminds me of with Iowa? I grew up in Detroit, so I was a Lions fan. I used to watch them on the weekends for the NFL or whatever, and they always had the game on Thanksgiving, and that was like prime real estate. You get a Thanksgiving national broadcast, no one to compete with, and as bad as the Lions were, they always had at least one national game a year, and that was Thanksgiving. And the reason was, back in the day, no teams wanted to play on a holiday, and the Lions kind of reluctantly said, oh, I guess we'll do it.
Okay.
So they've been grandfathered in, and now they have like the prime real estate for all of this, even though they've been terrible for as long as I can remember. Iowa kind of reminds me of a situation like that. All of a sudden, they are grandfathered in to be the start, the kickoff to all of this, based on even going back to the 70s, I guess. You know,
absolutely.
Well, with newspapers, just recently in Iowa, the big one out there endorsed Elizabeth Warren. There was a video that surfaced of her aides telling her, hey, congratulations, they're endorsing you, and her doing her little happy dance. She likes to show her videos online of doing dances and things. So she will ride that. Overall, do newspaper endorsements really move the needle for anyone?
Not really. The only thing it can do is it can take somebody out of obscurity, like it did John Edwards in 2004, for example, senator from North Carolina, down in the polls. The Des Moines Register that year endorsed him. He ended up finishing second place to John Kerry. People were saying, who is this person? It became just an elephantine story that somebody had gotten the endorsement that wasn't expected to get the endorsement. They were expecting it would be someone like Dick Gephardt, who won in 1988, for example. What it does, first of all, it gives you media coverage because you're getting the endorsement. Very few people, I think, go out there and say, well, I just read the editorial in my newspaper, so I think I'm going to endorse candidate X. I mean, most people are, if they're reading a conservative or a liberal editorial page, then they probably are ideological, and they probably already decide what they're going to vote for anyways. I will say, though, that sometimes it can actually work against you if, for example, a home state newspaper ends up endorsing somebody else. And this was actually interesting. In 1976, there are about 10 papers in Georgia, Jimmy Carter, former governor of Georgia, who endorsed Gerald Ford that year, the Republican. So what Ford did is he had an ad, and in the ad, but they made this basically people of Georgia that don't like Jimmy Carter. So they go to Georgia and they had people talking, and one person says, you know, Jimmy Carter, what did he do here? Someone said, oh, he's just a run-of-the-mill governor. Someone else says, it would be nice to have a president from Georgia, but not Carter. And then you have a listing of all the papers from Georgia that endorsed Gerald Ford. So that shows, I think, the fact that, you know, people who know Jimmy Carter the best are not the people who are supporting them. Obviously, there were other papers that were supporting Jimmy Carter, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the major one being one of them. But that's one example where I think you can really use it against somebody. Or the other one was the Kenny Bunkport newspaper in 1992. Kenny Bunkport is where George H.W. Bush has a summer home, and they endorsed Bill Clinton that year. So obviously the Clinton campaign had a field day by the fact that George H.W. Bush's, you know, I guess you could say hometown paper, at least for a summer home, was endorsing somebody else. But I mean, very rarely do they actually make that big of a difference, because most people are, especially, by the way, if it's something like a national newspaper like the New York Times. I mean, you know, the New York Times endorsing Elizabeth Warren. I don't think the guy in Davenport, Iowa, is thinking, well, the New York Times endorsing. They're probably more likely thinking, who did the Des Moines Register endorse, or for that matter, who did John Smith, who lives next door to me, endorse? Is probably more important than who's got the sign on his lawn than some newspaper, you know, in this metropolitan city like New York.
I also like to think that most people in New York may look at that as the standard that everyone in the world reads. And they have this sort of elitism concept that all of America, you know, we're in the Bible Belt. They're all waiting for the New York Times to tell us who to vote for. Yeah, no, I don't think so.
I'm sure the guy that's thinking about who's going to vote for governor of Mississippi is saying, wait to see what the New York Times comes out and says.
And plus, with the idea of newspapers endorsing, I still find that as a weird concept that newspapers still do that, and let alone.
Yep.
I know it's an editorial type of thing, and newspapers run editorials, but sure, it's still a little bit weird to go back and see some of those endorsements. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, absolutely. It used to be, though. I mean, originally in America, the newspapers were, in a sense, kind of house organs for certain ideologies. Thomas Jefferson's party had newspapers. John Adams' paper had newspapers, and they didn't try to make any sort of patina of being fair whatsoever. It was the newspaper's going to report this, the reporters are going to report this, and it's going to try to promote that person. We've kind of moved away from that. Now we're at a point where you have the editorial page is supposed to be separate, and even in the most, you know, even in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, reporters at least are supposed to try to be as uncolored as possible. But I mean, it really is interesting. You know, if you're getting your newspaper, you're trying to get news from that source. They always say, well, then, you know, you're supposed to get that information. You're not necessarily supposed to be getting, you know, what the editor of the newspaper. Why do you care about what somebody who writes an editorial page? Why is his opinion any better than the guy next door?
Yeah, I get that. It's probably better for you to talk to your neighbors anyway than try to read through between the lines of a New York Times. You know, and with all of the different candidates that they're out there and campaigning right now, and you have those that have their different strategies, you have three debates coming up next month. Let me just put this out there. Can they even have a Democratic debate if the impeachment trial is still going on, or would they have to cancel that?
It's a good question. I mean, I know that the one in New Hampshire is supposed to be a Friday night. So I would assume that they would not be having trial, that they would not be having it on that Friday night. But I don't know how that would necessarily would work. My guess is, though, they wouldn't cancel it. They would just not have the candidates assuming the trial is actually going on at that particular point in time, then I would assume the candidates would be in Washington. Then you only have the ones that were actually able to go to New Hampshire. But that's going to be interesting. I don't think that they would necessarily have it on a Friday night. I don't know if there's any way you could have them, you know, come in by satellite somehow. But they couldn't do it from the Senate floor, though.
Wouldn't that be something? Do you remember the show Futurama?
No.
Oh, well, it was a cartoon in, I would say, early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s. And there was a couple of different running gags. So the idea is the main character, Fry, is a pizza delivery guy. He's I would say early 20s, something like that. And he accidentally gets frozen into one of these, you know, these tubes or whatever. And then he wakes up like, you know, 100 years or 1,000 years in the future, whatever it is. And it's, you know, the world's foreign to him. So there's all these different advancements in technologies, you know, flying ships and the way people. Well, one of the things is they figured out how to, basically they can keep you alive forever. They put your head into a jar, and for whatever reason, it's still alive. So you don't have your body, but you still have a head. And one of the main characters is Richard Nixon's head runs for president. He becomes president again in the future, some, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years later. And when you say that they could set up a screen as the Democratic debates, it would remind me of that. It would look so futuristic and weird as if they were there on a giant iPad or whatever as they, you know, I guess there's stranger things that have happened in politics that wouldn't be the most confusing.
Well, they can't use technology as the problem. I guess they could go to the cloakroom and maybe do it there, and they could hand the microphone back and forth to one another. That reminds me of Ted Williams. I know he's cryogenically frozen when he died.
Oh, yeah.
So there are always people that say that, you know, that, yeah, that 2,000 years when they come up with the technology, he's going to come back. But my guess is that it won't matter what kind of a hitter you are 2,000 years from now, because I don't know if they're still going to have baseball then.
Yeah, well, there's no way that they would be able to do that, mostly because think of the advantages. Like, if they were able to get into a private space, they'd have all their aides there. They'd be writing notes for them. They'd be putting up cue cards. There were so many advantages to being remote, you know? So it would.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so they could basically get away with cheating at that point, so there's no way. I wonder if they would cancel it. What's the first debate in February? Do you know what location?
I don't know all I know is that the one in I do know it's in the one that's going to be the one at St. Anselm College. So the debate is the actual the primary is February 11th. That's going to be the Friday before, so that would be February 7th, I believe.
That's next Friday?
Yeah, that's the one. That's the last one in New Hampshire.
Yeah, I would think that that would be the one at risk right there, because, I mean, I can very easily see this continuing up until next Friday.
Assuming if it does continue based on what happened with Bolton, then, right, that could potentially work. That could potentially go into Friday, and my guess is that Mitch McConnell is not going to try to do something to accommodate the Democratic candidates.
No, not at all. Well, you know, people wanted to check you out online. Where can they find you?
Yep, just find me, Rich Rubino, R-U-B-I-N-O, on Facebook, or go to www.politigeek.com, or just Google my name.
Yeah, politigeek.com.
Dashgeek, correct.
Yes, and you can find some of your other books on there, too, including
American Politics on the Rocks.
Yeah, you do a lot of great books. I mean, people could check in and look it up on Amazon, too. Rich Rubino, thank you so much for coming on to Overnight America.
Glad to do it. Thank you so much.
We hook up with him every Monday, and I always enjoy doing that. He's on the TDK Technologies guest line on Overnight America KMOX.
This is Overnight America, sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com on KMOX.
Rich is so, so good. So good. Yeah, Mondays are a treat. I'm glad we get to spend all that time with him. Here's the phone number if you want to call in. Coming up after the top of the hour, by the way, Tom Sullivan in about 15 minutes from now. On the loop trolley, is it officially? I mean, that's essentially what the people in charge are saying at this point. Hey, should we get the trolley another before you could even finish the sentence? You give them the buzzer because that's the way it's looking right now. Don't even try it, or maybe not. 314-436-7900. Today was a historic day, the International Holocaust Remembrance Day. White House put out a statement. It says it's the day we remember millions of precious souls who perished as a result of the horrific crimes perpetrated by the Nazi regime. Also reaffirmed the steadfast commitment to confronting the vile poison of anti-Semitism whenever or wherever it arises. This year's annual observance marks the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. And same thing, too, here in St. Louis. We saw a story at KMOX.com. Here at the St. Louis Holocaust Museum and Learning Center, they announced an $18 million expansion plan that will triple its size. It's over in Grieve Corps. Pretty awesome facility. We've heard other people speak there. In fact, we've had guests in studio who were brought in specifically to speak to that. And I think it's wonderful that they're going to be able to extend that. I don't have a lot of history when it comes to World War II soldiers or those that were victims or those that were inside of a concentration camp. But I have known, and I got to say, I just wanted to share this real quick before we go to break. But when I was in Fort Wayne, I was part of the Optimist Club. So I wanted to be a part of a service group because, you know, you do charitable work. And the idea of the Optimist Club is to try to fundraise and help charities that primarily focus on children. So you want to be able to help your community and do it in a positive way. We had all kinds of guest speakers. And much like every service club everywhere, it's aging. It's so aging. So if you're part of a service club and you're young, you're a rarity, it seems like. I wasn't the youngest, but I was second to youngest in the group. And the only reason why someone was younger was because his dad was in the group too. They just did not see young blood sign up for these groups. So part of the demographic of the group is you had a pretty wide range of people, mostly retired at this point, that were part of the group for many years. And you got to meet them and talk to them and get to know their history and their story. And two of which were there in World War II, one of which, who has since passed, God love him, was there to liberate Auschwitz. And I remember this, and I'll never forget it. So we would sit and talk about this. And they were at this point, their retirement home. They were at assisted living. They were still independent. You know, they had their own places to live. But I would go there, and they had this cafeteria set up, and they'd always invite me to come eat lunch. And they had their little key card, and they say, oh, we'd never use all of them. So they were always buying me lunch. I loved it. So I went there. We'd sit down. We'd talk for an hour, and they would just tell me stories. Sometimes they would be war-related. Sometimes they wouldn't. We'd sit with Gene, and he always had some great stories of prison ministry and trying to save souls that way. And as we got to the stories of World War II, you learned that as they had more free time and moments, they became more curious of the world events that they were a part of. And as they fought for the United States, they would go and they would read the history books and the different accounts of what was going on. And then there'd be reference points, the things that they were a part of, and it had a lot of meaning to it. They would get to the point of history where the United States would free concentration camps, and he would start to tell the story, and it always got to the same part before he had to turn his head and say, I can't talk about this anymore. He said the things that he witnessed when they first got there, and then he would turn his head and he would start to tear up. And even now, me thinking about it, I start to tear up because you'd see the look on their face and you knew that whatever they saw, whatever they experienced, it was something that was not only life-changing, but it was also something that was world-changing. And I'll never forget that. It's good to go back and make sure you share these stories with your kids and the next generation so that they'll never forget this. 75 years doesn't seem that long ago, but it is. And you'd probably be surprised how often these stories go unspoken. This is Overnight America, KMOX.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.